So, James, did you have a favorite toy store when you were a kid?
I wasn't allowed to play with toys. I just got a stick and a broken bottle. Those are my toys. Oh. Did I have a favorite toy store when I was a kid? Yes. Yeah, I guess I did.
Well, I grew up with a little toy store in town that they shut down when I was 13, and I remember my sister and I being horrified. But we used to love going in there and looking at the shelves and just walking aisle to aisle. And, I mean, toys were amazing. They were colorful and they were exciting. And in particular, when I grew up in the late 70s, early 80s, Star Wars figures. I remember seeing lines of these little action figures, and you could see them from a mile away because they were sitting in the blister packs, a black backing and all that. And today when I go into a beer store, it's sort of the same thing. From way down the aisle, you can see groupings and categories of products and all that. So, you know, with that in mind, you and I had talked for a while about how do we look into some of this stuff and talk about how things end up on the shelf and how breweries make these decisions to advertise their products in a certain way and advertise their tap rooms in a certain way and convey their image and their branding to an audience. So as with most research, I started doing some Googling, and I stumbled across an ad agency that's out of Indianapolis, Indiana, and they specialize in this type of thing specifically for breweries. So happy to bring onto the program today Kodo Design. We've got Cody Fague and Isaac Arthur with us. Hi, guys.
Hey there.
Hello.
So tell us a little bit, if you could, about, you know, what you guys do, how you ended up in the craft beer industry. And then we'll start talking about branding and then trying to convey to our audience exactly what it is you guys do and bring to the table for these breweries.
Cody and I met, this is Isaac, Cody and I met back in 2006-ish at college. I was Heron School of Art and Design here in Indianapolis, Indiana, and we bonded very quickly over schoolwork, freelance work, this new thing called craft beer outside of that. And then even further than that, over internship experiences that he and I had each had, where we saw in both cases, different shops. He was at a large PR firm doing design work. I was at a design shop. And we each saw the creative industry creating a barrier between the clients and designers. There was always this firewall of slick dressed account managers who would take the work from the designers and present it to the clients and then work with them to build that brief and come back. And we saw from our side as lowly interns, this created a whole host of issues like blown deadlines, blown budgets, blown morale, and really just subpar work usually. So we thought that we could create better work by putting collaboration at the center of everything we do. If we could break down that barrier and bring our clients into the creative process as early, intimately, and often as possible, that we could create better work. So we graduated May 10th, 2009. We founded Kodo the following Monday. So actually our unofficial or our semi-unofficial, I don't know how you say it, anniversaries, 10-year anniversary is coming up right now, but our official anniversary is July 25 because that's we got our state paperwork, I guess. But we started working with nonprofits up front for the first year and a half or so. Then we stumbled into working with the Indianapolis City Market, which put us in touch with the Brewers of Indiana Guild and working with Tomlinson Tap Room and branding that. And that put us into touch with a lot of different breweries around Indiana. And we kind of blinked, and 8 years later, we've worked with about 50, right? I mean, that's kind of skipped over too much there. But
Yeah. Well, no, I think the toy store question was funny because I think you can even, like, in one of, I forget which piece it is that we've written, but Isaac talked about kind of growing up, being a kid and wandering in the grocery store into the beer aisle and just looking at the wine labels and the beer packaging. And that would have been right around the time that things like Flying Dog or Anchor Steam were hitting distribution in Indiana, I think. And that artwork was really captivating, I think, even for like kids who probably shouldn't have been wandering around in the beer aisle.
Nah, it's fine.
But, you know, if you're a visual person and you respond to things that way, it became this really cool kind of place to express themselves. And that became part of the culture of what breweries are. So flash forward to today, we're making that stuff, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, and I guess we should probably kind of clearly lay out too. I think we're a 7-person design firm. We focus in the food and beverage industry. So bars, restaurants, hospitality groups, distilleries, wineries, cannabis startups, food artisans. The reason we're here talking to you guys today, craft beer, as I mentioned, I think we've worked with about 50 now. Our bread and butter would be brand strategy, naming, identity design, packaging, web design, environmental design, and marketing.
So when you talk about branding, and I think that's something that needs to be really defined for folks, because for the most part, I have to imagine breweries are typically started by a business person and a brewer, and they come together and say, okay, we're making beer. What else really is there to do? And you very quickly figure out that there's a lot of other stuff to do. So let's define branding, because it's not just having an Instagram account. That doesn't get you where you need to go.
It doesn't?
Uh-oh. Could have fooled me.
Shoot.
No. So there's a lot of ways to define branding. And if you want kind of like the textbook one, there's a lot of great books you can read on it too. But the way we tend to think about branding, and it gets kind of nebulous and fuzzy really quickly, but ultimately, the idea is that what you're doing, what you're selling, or the service you're providing, or whatever it is going to make someone feel a certain way. So for us, all branding is drawing a circle around how someone should feel about something or does feel about something, and then figuring out how to represent that best visually. The reason we approach it that way is because, I mean, as much as those packages captivated us when we were younger, the packaging itself is not just the branding. It's an output of the branding. And branding should really kind of encapsulate like an emotional kind of ballpark, you know, for how people are going to respond to something emotionally. But hopefully it also represents some of the things that you stand for, right? So we've seen kind of the success of the independent seal that independent breweries are putting on all their packaging, and how much traction that program has had. And that's kind of a good example of, well, yeah, branding has a logo, but it also has a set of values behind it. And that's kind of how we tend to think about it. So kind of the back end is, what do you believe and why are you doing what you're doing? And the front end is, how do you very quickly and effectively and emotionally convey that to someone who might really like what you're doing?
And how much of that really gets built up in the conceptual phases of a brewery and then changes over time? I imagine you've worked with plenty of breweries who really haven't been sure of what their brand really is, because making good beer that's not enough to be a brand. There's got to be something more to it.
For sure. Yeah, it sounds kind of coy, but branding is something that really never stops in the first place. It should be, you don't really reach an end point and go, okay, we're done with that. Check that box. Now we can move on to the next thing. But when we're working with a brewery, whether it is a brewery in planning or whether we're rebranding now 25, 30-year-old folks, it's all about defining that story. And you're right. It's kind of mind-boggling in a way, talking to people that have been wildly successful, multi-tens of millions of dollar annual revenue companies that don't really know what they do that makes them special. They just kind of, in spite of themselves, make great beer, and they have this compelling brand, I guess you call it, that keeps them going. And our job is to help people sort that out early on, or again, whether we're rebranding, and figure out how we can better tell that and hone that and help them. You know, another word that we should probably define here would be positioning with branding. That's something that's becoming more important as more and more breweries open around the country. So helping them figure out what place in the market they occupy. And that's through what we do, like three questions usually. What do you do? What type of beer do you brew? What's your concept? Who is that for? And then how are you different from everyone else? So all of those things culminate in, generally for us, naming, branding, packaging, stuff like that.
The who is that for question, I think, is very interesting, because I guess idealistically, I'd like to think that there's something deeper in the reason that you've opened your own business, you being the brewer, in the sense that, you know, this is what I'm trying to provide, this is what I'm trying to give, and how I'm putting myself out there, as opposed to the, you know, how many IPAs can I put on my menu? I guess is the style du jour. You know what I'm saying there? Like, there's a there's some introspection that has to go on in terms of why you're really doing this sort of thing. How do you pull that out of someone?
I think this has happened, especially over the last couple of years, as we kind of matured as a company and felt more confident. I mean, pushing people beyond that trite, like you mentioned, making good beer up front. We still hear breweries say, you know, we want to make great beer for everyone. And that's fine. It's table stakes, of course, but everyone isn't your audience. Like, if someone's buying a 24 pack of Busch Light, for example, they're not going to pay $11 for a 6-pack of IPA. And that's okay. You need to focus on who your audience is and who will support you and who will love what you do. And then double down on them because they're going to bring their friends in. They're gonna be your biggest fans and evangelists. So as far as who that's for and how we push them, a lot of it is just asking those questions and really challenging the stuff that comes across as, I don't know, table stakes. Would you say that's
the way? Yeah, I mean, the we've had this conversation more and more lately, and it's kind of – it's this idea of – is just talking about beer and the kind of the beer industry, like to what degree is beer a commodity, especially as craft breweries, the growth and opening of new craft breweries has continued to rise. And then additionally, like a lot of similar or adjacent or related kind of competitive things, like as cannabis is legalized, as people become more carbohydrate conscious and switch maybe to like spirits or wine, kind of looking at maybe the fallacy of treating craft beer as a commodity, assuming that if you open it and you have the right things on your list and you make it well, that's going to be enough. I think people more than they did 5 years ago, I would say even, are seeing that writing on the wall now where they know that they need to really push and figure out who they're for because they're looking around and seeing all these other people kind of, you know, coming for their hen house. I don't know. It's different for everyone. And a lot of it is going there and like just kind of seeing the tap room and seeing who's coming and picking up on the vibe. Like when we're working with out of town people, it becomes really important to travel and go see it because there's kind of information we're going to glean from that experience that maybe you can't really get from an interview, if that makes sense. And kind of some generalizations we can draw from that.
Sure. And I guess there's only so many pictures of the same tap room with the high exposed ceilings and the concrete floors that, you know, over and over and over again, being in there and getting the sense of the vibe and all that does make a difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course.
With the crowded market, as you mentioned, I mean, there's so much out there right now. I mean, how do you balance that need to go between, okay, you've got to differentiate yourselves to show what's special, but you've also got to be true to your core? There's got to be a balance there.
Generally, those things align. One thing that we're very bullish on is not making up stories. And sometimes that's challenging, right? I mean, if you have, let's say, this is early on in our career, but a couple guys that have money, they want to open a brewery. They don't know anything about beer. And I'm not saying they're good or bad or whatever, but you have to really dig to figure out. It's easier maybe if we're naming them, but why are you existing? I know that's a way overused term or concept, but Simon Sinek, start with why. I mean, if we can dig and figure out why you're doing this and why it's compelling and why it should matter and what role you're playing in the community and in people's lives, that's a good place to start that generally can help those two ideas align.
And the community piece is something that we talk about quite a bit on a variety of levels, just how important it is now to be involved. First of all, to just the appearance of being involved, but in addition to that, just making sure that you're so you mentioned community, and certainly that's very important, and it's something that I think is expected nowadays, especially from a local business and most breweries that when we talk about craft brewing, and I imagine that you've worked with are local shops. I mean, maybe you've got a couple of multi-site, but they're fundamentally community-based. I think there's an expectation in the general public nowadays that you're going to give back locally. You're going to try and source ingredients locally. I was at a place near me just last night, and they had a big fundraiser for the local softball team. And on a Wednesday night, the place was mobbed. But it was something that was, you know, clearly being done with the local community in mind.
that's just a function too of kind of like, I think it's one of the big kind of tack on benefits of craft beer from a branding perspective, which is that you can actually like shake the hand of the guy who owns the company potentially, where, you know, with macro beer and kind of some of the faux craft brands, they're just completely disassociated from any kind of community at all. So I think that's a big benefit because then you kind of have this emotional sort of like pleasant feeling that goes along with consuming that product. And that's completely aside from how much you might like it.
Yeah. And that rides I guess it'd be 20 years in the making now, right? But a broader cultural ethos now of wanting to know who's making your stuff and support local and for economic reasons or for whatever reasons. And craft beer, to be successful, really does need to have a local base before they do anything else. Because otherwise, yeah, you're not going to make it.
And, you know, it's interesting you mentioned the macro guys. They can't do that. And yet it immediately brings to mind to me, I want to say it's Bud Light, that when the NFL season starts, we'll put logos of the local teams on the local distribution. So there's an attempt to connect, and they're, you know, I don't know if they're paying for that or the NFL's paying them to do it, but there's at least a grasp there at trying to connect with your local audience somehow, because that has to resonate with someone.
There is a humanoid connection there.
A human-like.
Yeah.
Human-esque.
They are trying. And I'm sure it works for their audience, but yeah.
I think, though, that something that's often overlooked, willfully or not, when we're talking about, if we're talking about the part of the branding of being, you know, local being a thing that's expected or could be capitalized upon, is, you know, local washing, you know, as opposed to like greenwashing, where it's come support our local brewery, where, you know, in your community, and that's all fine and dandy. But where that brewery may not be sort of paying it forward, you know, and sourcing their ingredients locally or building that relationship, you know, further down their supply chain to truly be local. How do, when building a brand or when you're, you know, vetting even potential customers to work with, how do you sort through that hyperbole? And does it really matter the stage where you guys get involved?
And when we're vetting clients or potential clients, for example, you know, we're really, it's not scientific. We're on the phone with them. We're on Skype. We're listening to them. We're seeing if we like them. We're seeing if we think we can do great work with them, if their business is actually scalable, or if we think, if it's a newer brewery, you know, if their business plan itself is somewhat sound. So we're, I don't know if I'm answering your question even, but we poke around and kind of make sure that it's going to be a good fit before we jump in bed with folks.
Right. And it's, you know, not even so much with big beer. I mean, that I don't even pretend to. I mean, they couldn't even local wash if they tried, but it's pretty much a joke to most folks when they do. But it's even the craft brewers, the neighborhood brewers, where they want to capitalize on their local nature. How much, and it's not necessarily the local aspect. I guess I'm just looking at when you're developing a brand and you're dealing with, you know, clients that are obviously excited about what they do, how do you cut through the hyperbole without getting rid of the actual pizzazz? You know what I mean?
You know, a lot of times, I think I do. And a lot of times, like, the problem, because it's just, and it's got a lot to do with the type of person who wants to cut out on their own and start a brewery, or the type of people that want to do that. We actually need to help them with the hyperbole a little bit, amplify the hyperbole, if you will, because either they're not sure, or, you know, just from like, it's kind of tough from your own perspective to kind of objectively judge, you know, what your strengths and weaknesses are. So a lot of times they're just not sure, and they don't know what's going to work. So I don't see much. The only times I've seen that really pop up is when people are kind of doing weird stuff with contract brewing, and I don't have anything against that at all, but there are times where I kind of raise my eyebrow at someone whose business plan heavily involves contract brewing, because then they're also trying to attach it to a community that they may or may not even be making the stuff there. And so that's always kind of bizarre to me, but it's kind of few and far between on that type of thing. And usually the people we're talking to are pretty straightforward and up, just because it's hard to be when you don't have a ton of resources. It's hard to try to trick people into thinking that you're something that you're not.
So what is the problem that you see folks run into when they do come to you for a rebranding, for example? How are folks identifying that they've got a problem? Because clearly they're not reaching out to you to spend money just because they've got it laying around. You don't hear about breweries with extra money laying around typically. What is it that clues them in that they maybe don't have a brand strategy that they should have, or that they're missing something?
Loads of things. I mean, we can run through a laundry list here, right? Sales can be flat. You can be losing sale from upper tier of craft, crushing you on volume and pricing, and then the younger guys stealing energy and excitement because they have more nimble, they can have more nimble releases. Aesthetics can wander and not be consistent or never be in the first place. Just it seems to be death by a thousand cuts when we work with people, because it's, I don't know what logo to send to my glass vendor.
Yeah,
I don't
know. We've been making this beer forever, and I keep running into people who don't realize they're both from us. Or sales guy says, "Oh no, like I just lost another tap handle at XYZ restaurant."
Every single project we take on here is completely reinventing the wheel. Nothing is easy, and it's horrible. We hear stuff like that from breweries of all sizes that are looking to rebrand. And a lot of that is just because they've never been through this process in the first place. I mean, even if you just have, like, let's say you don't go through a crazy branding project and you just hire a freelancer to do a logo suite for you, you're going to be better off than if you didn't have that sort of asset bank in place.
This concept of, going into a rebrand when you may not have even gone through a proper branding before, I mean, what does that look like?
Really, it's weighing brand equity up front. There are a couple of big differences between foundational branding for a new company and then rebranding. And we found that brand equity is the biggest consideration, right? So we're doing things like weighing your visual brand equity. Are there any colors or icons or, I don't want to talk about Kettle House because we can't look at it while we're on a podcast, but I'll give you an example. There's a 23-year-old brewery out in Montana that we are, as we speak, launching their rebrand. They have had a yellow K and a black house in their logo for about 20 to 23 years. So for us to come in and suggest changing that when everything they're doing is going well, they just want to clean up everything and have basically set themselves up for the next 23 years. We could never touch that. We just have to clean it up. So identifying what elements we have to keep and what elements we can jettison is a big part. Along with that are, I guess, packaging keys, anything really that is a direct signifier, especially in the off-premise or anything like that setting where we know that we need to retain it. So that's a big one.
You know, guys, you mentioned the potential example of someone who comes to you and says, we're hearing from our customers, they don't realize these two beers even come from us. And I believe that's the whole concept of a house of brands versus a branded house that you've talked about. Yes, I've read the articles on your website. and more and more, I think we're seeing that branded house architecture coming about, where it's a very standard logo that's in the same place all the time on the packaging, and maybe it's a different color scheme going across. So you've got kind of that view. And then you've got the wild and crazy cans and bottles and names that have no relation to each other, and they're just silly, and you couldn't possibly guess what's in the bottle from the way they're shown there.
Yeah, I think that phenomenon specifically is just people sort of realizing that, especially the small, like the mid to smaller tier guys, are recognizing that the amount of exposure they have is kind of capped at the resources that they can put into it. So in terms of having spots on shelves in stores or having tap handles, like wherever you are now, you need to maximize that. And if you only have a few spots versus, a whole grocery set from floor to ceiling down the aisle, you're going to need to be a little bit more intentional with how you're getting your name out there and how you're kind of getting your message and your whole shtick out there. Because you just have a lower volume of places to do that. So I think that's kind of the business side of things, saying, how do we maximize what we have so that everybody knows that it's us wherever, whenever, however they see us, they know that it's us, even if we only have kind of limited exposure.
Yeah. The branded house just makes sense for most breweries. I mean, when you get into more brand architecture type things like extensions and line extensions or brand extensions, that's when you might consider because it's 2019, what a time to be alive. Breweries are making seltzers and CBD infused,
kombucha.
Yeah. It's stuff that's not beer, but they're still breweries. So it's interesting. But that's when you start to consider, do we move maybe more away from the branded house into a house of brands, or maybe this is a completely different company or something. So
I would think you've got to be pretty large for that to make sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. I mean,
The only other times I see it make sense are when you go so far the other way and it's so crazy that you get known for that. But for by and large, you have to maximize what you have, and you have to be as consistent as you can with what you have to just to get a foothold in people's minds.
So, and you talked about going so far away from your core. I have an example I learned years ago. This was always one of my favorites about a Campbell's soup. I'm sure you guys know this story. Campbell's soup came out with pasta sauce years ago, and could not sell it. Everyone, all the surveys said it's soupy, it's watery, it just doesn't seem like pasta sauce. They took it back in, they rebranded it, and that's Prego. It's on the shelves, it's very successful, it's made by them. If you look at the label, you can see it's by Campbell's Soup Company, but they all that brand equity in Campbell's Soup, and they couldn't use it to get people to buy a different product because they were so focused on the soup and that this should be like soup. So I can see that, I suppose, with the house of brands. If you are doing something radically different, wanting to split them up and keep them separate to give something new its own identity.
Exactly. Yeah, you want to make sure you're not undercutting. I mean, you're not going to cannibalize, but you want to make sure you're not undercutting or competing with or hurting the positioning of the parent brand, because that's what brought you to the dance. So, and I wouldn't have even thought of the soup idea, but that makes complete sense.
So something else we wanted to get into with you guys is CBC, which just happened a few weeks ago.
Yes, it did. And
you were there in Denver. If you could tell us a little, we were not. So if you could tell us a little bit about it, the Craft Brewers Conference.
Still wrapping my head around the whole experience. There are 10 to 15,000 people there. We got snowed in. Well, I mean, tentatively snowed in. Then we didn't, but our plane was canceled. It was a wild week for us. But, I think a lot of the things we're seeing, which are going to be, it's actually, 2 weeks from now? Our 2019 Branding Trends piece launches. A lot of it is coming from that conference or just reiterated at that conference. It's interesting to watch a rise, and this is something that you guys know about. I don't want to say artisanal, but with provenance heavy or provenance laden ingredients. So speaking to the hops that they're grown down the road and they're in this beer or this craft maltster, and using that as a way to further differentiate breweries. We're seeing a lot of that on the B2B side, which is cool. I think the example we give in our trends piece is like a Cummins engine and a Dodge, like that sort of thing. Like people are speaking to that. So that's a big one. And then we saw it, I guess, by drinking some beer out there, but really just the light craft is got to be the biggest trend. It's like shaking the industry, right? Not shaking, but will be. This is the same conversation that's going to happen for the next 3 years. As the biggest breweries start to make and focus directly on putting calorie and carb count on cans and using that as positioning and moving this also interestingly more towards kind of that traditional macro positioning. And we're seeing small brew, like I think we've done 10 of them so far, including we're working on a campaign right now. I won't talk about the brewery or the state or anything, but we're working to be the first and kind of own that mind share of being the light lager of that state. So that's a mega trend that it's probably been I think we called that in 2017 if you look back at those trends, and now it's just coming into full swing with every article you read on Dogfish Head. They're releasing a new can kind of in that space, and interesting positioning ideas about like brewing it with what, electrolytes and sea salt, and calling it a recovery beer. I don't know how any of that's legal.
Beer is healthy now.
Beer is healthy. Yeah. So we're good. We're not fat. We're healthy. Yeah,
that's interesting, because a few years ago, one good friends of ours, Potosi Brewing Company, southwestern Wisconsin, they came out with a light craft beer, and people just were like, "What the heck are you thinking? You can't compete against, you know, Miller Lite at, you know, when your six pack costs, you know, $11 or whatever it happens to be." But it's damn good beer, and you know, I don't know, maybe they were just a little bit too early, but it's a thing.
I like them. I mean,
yeah, it's a thing.
Oh no, I'm a fan of the trend. I mean, I confided in Cody about a month ago that on the weekends I've been buying six packs of Corona for a while, because I'm tired of drinking IPAs, and now I mean, if I can grab a slightly hoppy Pilsner, that's outstanding, and that's what I'd like to do, have a couple and not get completely bombed out, and also not ruin my diet. So yeah, it's cool.
Yep, see, Greg, I'm not the only one.
Yeah, well, I mentioned on last week's podcast that it's nice having a face and body for podcasting, because no one, you know, really needs to know.
That's why, yeah, Kodo hides behind long form 4,000 word blogs. We don't put our face out there, because right, our faces aren't really that attractive. So
we're kind of lumpy.
Yeah, we're potato-y. Yeah, not good.
And I think we have the title of this episode.
Potato-y.
We're potato-y.
Uh huh.
So light as a craft beer style, that is very interesting in a time when we can't seem to think of more weird stuff to float on top of an IPA, to go the light route is certainly an interesting thing. Anything else that jumped out as something new that people should watch for?
Another one, and we were seeing it walking around the different vendor booths at CBC, but packaging is becoming a little bit more environmentally conscious.
Yeah.
I only mention this because we saw kind of some examples of it. I think the price point's not quite there yet, I think, for a lot of the smaller guys, but
example, edible six pack rings,
right?
Fully 100%. I'm probably saying this wrong, but post consumer recycled X, Y, and Z. That's cool. Once the big boys kind of shepherd that, like you're seeing, what was it, Carlsberg?
I think Carlsberg picked up like an adhesive based one that is like fully, like it'll decompose.
No,
so
six pack ring anymore. So
yeah, so I guess the idea is that as these big guys start to pick this stuff up and these things are produced in volume, that hopefully the price point will become more accessible for everyone else. I think we're still a couple of years out for that. However, seeing people pick that up in all its different permutations, even just for like a branding and marketing message, it is something that's starting to happen and will continue to happen.
Maybe just one more to mention would be augmented reality. We first saw that with 19 Crimes, the winery that did it, that kind of blew up the industry. And we wrote this trends piece a couple months ago. We've been writing it for 4 or 5 months really, but we wrote that we think breweries are going to start doing this. And while we were doing it, we started seeing breweries doing augmented reality. So you hold your phone up to a beer can, and then that reads the label and it tells you some story. So there's like some sort of moving picture or video or something like that. So we are starting to see that. And that's an interesting trend. I think you're going to see some really fun stuff. I don't know if it made it into the final piece or not, but I think we're going to see a Super Bowl campaign probably from one of the big boys using that, because it's novel and that'll bump sales for a quarter.
It'll make the beer taste better too.
Yeah, it will. Yeah.
So, guys, backing up one to the, you mentioned the environmentally conscious rings for the six packs, and all you said edible, and all I can think of is, you know, a beef jerky holding together a six pack of beef. that's my weekend.
Yeah,
that's a way better idea.
Yeah, you could take that out to like a campsite and you're set.
Yeah, I've got one quick question. In terms of the labeling of cans nowadays, the trend of smaller brewers, maybe less capital, liquid capital brewers, you know, they're buying blank cans, silver cans, and they're using either shrink labels or adhesive labels, and it seems like that technology's come a long way. I just wanted to get your guys' two cents on the actual physical label.
We're seeing a lot of breweries actually move directly to that, even from sleeves, because it is so much easier to manage. It makes them faster turnaround. It's cheaper to design. You can print them super, low to no minimums and have it delivered the next day. So it's very cool in that regard. It's really easy. And now we do have a trend, I'll let Cody talk through it, where that has become the official trade dress of nimble, cool, ephemeral, generally New England-y-ish type beers. But we found something really fun.
Yeah, so
in doing this.
Right as that whole thing of having a label, what's called a pressure-sensitive label applied to a blank can. Yeah, usually tall boy, but sometimes not. Like we just helped kind of do a brand refresh with Left Field Brewery up in Toronto. And they do kind of a similar thing, but with 12-ounce cans. But basically the idea is you put cool art on a pressure-sensitive label, wrap it around the can, and that way you're not beholden to sitting on top of a bunch of cans in warehouse or whatever. So that hit critical mass. And because, it's kind of an example of innovation, even though you might say, depending on the implementation, it looks worse than a direct printed can. It's kind of an innovation that smaller breweries have done. Right as that hit critical mass, we noticed that Sam Adams released a New England IPA. And even though they used direct printed cans, so they actually, they put ink onto the metal.
Print by the millions, yeah.
They did it so that it looked like a pressure-sensitive label. So right before the shoulder of the can, there's nothing printed. It's just blank aluminum. And my eyes about popped out of my head when I saw that, because it was like...
little tone deaf.
Yeah, what are you guys trying to accomplish with that? Like, either just do a label or... Now, they've like since changed it.
Like a hospitality group spending $10 million to make your place look like a stripped back.
Right. Yep. The big guys have obviously seen that. Like, they're aware of that as kind of like a way to say, hey,
the cachet.
There's a certain type of beer in this, and I think there's like certain assumptions they hope that you're going to make when you see that kind of format.
I'm ready for the game. beer, no, is that what it is?
Beer, no.
I've been studying up on this.
Okay, so went with some marketing and web design beer style names here. So beer or no is, are these real beers or did I just make them up? So the first one is Trademark Dispute Imperial Stout.
I feel like that's real given, and I feel like it's a beer name given the climate that we live in.
Yeah, I'm going to say that that's real just because I'm sure that someone got a C&D from someone else and passive-aggressively named their beer Trademark Dispute. So I'm going to say that's real.
That's probably what happened. It is real. Man. Cycle Brewing Company in St. Petersburg, Florida. So you're one for one. Yes. Next one is Brand Ambassador Oktoberfest.
I hope that's fake. I'm going to call that fake.
I hope it's fake too, but I don't hate it.
I hate it.
Well, I made that one up. So
okay, all right.
So we were split. So we're one and a half.
No, I said I liked it, but I
For two, baby.
I think it's fake, but I liked it.
All right. So next one, Market Buzz Brute IPA.
That's fake.
Mm.
That's bad.
Yeah, like, but it's kind of also kind of oxymoron, just because everyone's a buzz about brewed IPAs. I just had a really good one yesterday at Fountain Square Brewing up the street.
Digging that style.
I'm going to say no, that's not a real name.
Clearly, I should not go into the naming business myself, because, yes, I made that one up. It's another bad one. All right.
Three.
Next one, Helvetica IPA.
I feel like that would be real.
Hmm.
It's a stupid name. What do you think, Cody?
Boy, I bet somebody did it.
Designerly nerds out there.
Yeah, there was a documentary about the font, so there's probably a beer, too. I'm going to say that exists.
Yeah.
It is a beer from the North Brewery in Endicott, New York. Funny thing about that one, when I was reading about it, the guys behind the bar at the tap room, when someone they don't recognize comes in and asks for that and says, oh, this is kind of curious, I'll try the Helvetica IPA. They'll deadpan look at them and say, oh, we don't serve that type.
Yuck. They give you a myriad, kind of a default myriad beer and stuff.
Yeah. Font not found.
All right, last one I've got for you is shelf space.
Oh, that would be funny, but it's almost like it's too smart to be real. Oh, boy.
Hey, well, here, before we answer, has anyone ever scored 5 out of 5?
I don't believe so.
Okay, so we gotta actually
think about this. No Googling.
Yeah, shelf space?
Yeah, we're not.
No, we're not. We're honorable. I'm going to say no, only because he didn't give a style.
Well, he said IPA.
Oh, did he?
But I'm going to say no, too. I don't know why.
No, we're putting all on the line.
It's real.
Damn it.
Curses.
Wandering Hot Brewing in the Yakima Valley in Washington.
Wow. Well, hats off to you guys, because that's like the most meta-textual beer name I've ever heard. So, yeah, tip of the cap.
4 out of 5, still quite good, something to be quite proud of.
Yeah. It's a solid B-.
And we've learned that my made-up ones are a little too easy. I'll have to get a little more difficult. It's everything I thought of was out there. It's amazing how many ridiculous names you can find.
7,300 breweries. Yeah.
Imagine if someone was paying you to do that. You'd have to be like, uh-oh. Gotta find something.
It's always interesting coming up with 10 really good ideas, and they still don't like them. You're like, what?
Yeah.
I'm keeping these.
Right. We're going to put these back in the hopper.
Yeah.
Well, I do want to make sure that the listeners know they can find you guys at cododesign.com. It's CODO design.com. And for the listeners, these guys have a blog with all kinds of case studies, things that they've done with breweries as well as other establishments, really interesting stuff. So please take a visit. And I know you mentioned in about 2 weeks the 2019 study comes out.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. We've got everything pretty much ready to go. We're just waiting on a few little more pieces. And then, yeah, we'll be pushing that out here in a couple weeks.
Our most comprehensive deep dive we've done. I think we started in 16, so this would be our fourth year. And it's, I'd be saying 4,000 words is stupid because that doesn't mean they're good words.
But yeah.
It's a very detailed look visually and non-visually at what's going on in the industry. And I think it's going to be a good tool for breweries to keep their eye on the horizon and stay relevant or more relevant.
Anything else you've got coming up that you want to plug here?
Well, the only thing I would mention in addition is if you're interested in the topic of branding as it applies to craft beer, we wrote kind of a micro book about it and it exists online at craftbeerbrandingguide.com. And that's free. You can go check it out. We've got examples of our work, and we kind of break it down from the bare bones all the way to like the finished product, released it. So check that out if the topic interests you and you want to just kind of know more about our position on that kind of stuff.
It's well worth a read. I've read it, and that's how I knew what questions to ask today. So yes, very, very much worth the time. Cody, Isaac, thank you so much for spending time with us today. We really appreciate it. And you know, as strategies change and new things come up, we would love to talk to you again and continue the conversation with this evolving marketplace.
Absolutely. Thank you, guys. We appreciate the opportunity.
Good talking to you.